Today on the show, we are talking about the famous fish Dunkleosteus. This episode, we dive into the Devonian-aged oceans, sink our teeth into placoderms, discuss the evolution of armor in fish, and get down and dirty with claspers. Get ready to get wet. Pals in Paleo presents Dunkleosteus. Let's go back. This is Pals in Paleo, the show where we dive into the form, function, and family groupings of your favorite fossils. I'm your host, paleontologist, PhD student, and fish enthusiast Adele Pentland. You can stay up to date with me and the show by following on Instagram at Pals in Paleo. Okay, deep breath, let's dive into today's episode. Pals in Paleo acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land throughout Australia and recognises their connections to land, sea, sky and community. We pay our respects to the elders past, present and emerging and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today. This episode was recorded on Kaur Country in Winton, central western Queensland, and fossils of Dunkleosteus are known from parts of North America, Morocco, Belgium and Poland. Just wanted to quickly mention that the audio for one of our guests on today's episode, Amanda McGee, isn't spectacular. Sounds like it's been chewed up and spat out through a wormhole, but we wanted to include it because Amanda has some really cool insights about Dunkleosteus. So just bear with us on that. And I also just wanted to say thank you and acknowledge that this episode is a week late because I was at a conference. I was at Paleo Down Under 3, which is something that I've been looking forward to for years and years. And I had a spectacular time, but it also really threw my schedule out of whack, but hopefully it's been worth the wait, and I hope you enjoy. Today, I'm taking you to the Devonian, also known as the Age of Fishes, and talking about one of the superstars from this time period, the famous armored fish, Dunkleosteus. But before I start dunking on you, as is tradition, we're starting this episode off with our random fossil fact. It would be almost irresponsible of me to deprive you of this fact before we hear more about Dunkleosteus. Heaps of amazing paleontology podcasts delve into the news and discuss groundbreaking discoveries, but because there's so much amazing research going on all the time, it's easy to sometimes overlook some insanely cool discoveries. Random fossil fact time also means I just have another excuse to info dump about paleontology, but kind of zoom in and get into the nitty gritty details of something that's a bit more obscure. Today's random fossil fact is on the discovery of a new species of Triassic beetle, wait for it, found in a coprolite. We talked briefly about coprolites in episode 4, again during the random fossil fact. And if you missed that episode or haven't heard of coprolites before, they are a type of trace fossil, specifically fossil poo. We also talked about scanning coprolites in our bonus episode on VAMP, the Virtual Australian Museum of Paleontology, with special guests Dr. Aaron Kamens, Dr. Alice Clement, and PhD candidate Jacob Van Zolen. Getting back to coprolites though, I thought I remembered hearing in undergrad that coprolites got their name when one scientist was being kind of petty and mean to another scientist, and as it turns out, that is false. Just a quick tangent here on the etymology or the origins of the name coprolite. You might have heard of the Bone Wars and the famous rivalry between two toxic men, Cope and Marsh. They absolutely hated each other, and they both went to great lengths to throw shade, spill tea, and sabotage their rivals' research. It got pretty intense and was definitely a very bitter rivalry. If you want to hear more about Cope and Marsh, these two pioneering but super problematic paleontologists, I highly recommend episode 250 of I Know Dino. If you like Facts on Dinosaurs, that's a great podcast to listen to. I've listened to hours of their show, and I've also been a guest on their podcast a couple of times now. It's run by a husband and wife duo, Garrett and Sabrina, and they also visited the Winton area in 2019. So I've actually met them in person at our museum. We hung out afterwards, and they are true dinosaur enthusiasts. Episode 250 is Sabrina's summary of the spat between Marsh and Cope, and it's incredibly thorough. It's a solid 2.5 hours long. So if you like listening to long podcasts while you go about your day, that's a great one to chuck on and listen to. I'll have a link to that in the show notes, along with the other podcast recommendations and specific papers that I'll mention throughout this episode. Getting back to Marsh and Cope, it's tempting to think that Marsh named fossil feces after his rival to besmirch his name and basically give him a crappy reputation forever and ever. Again, it sounds kind of convincing and honestly on brand for how much these two hated each other, but it's not true. Coprolite has Greek origins and is based on two words, kopros, which means dung, and lithos, which means stone. The person who coined the word coprolite was, in fact, William Buckland, an English geologist and paleontologist who is credited for writing the first description of a dinosaur fossil when he named Megalosaurus. He was working on stuff way before Marsh and Cope's time, so again, the name coprolite isn't related to their famous feud. Coprolites come in different shapes and sizes. If they're more spiral-shaped, then there's a chance that it belongs to a shark or other fish since they have spiral-shaped intestines. Another random fossil fact for you. They come in other shapes too, but you know what? I'm just going to leave that up to you to use your imagination. Coprolites are incredibly useful trace fossils since they can reveal clues as to how different species in an ecosystem interacted with one another. Normally, it's almost impossible to work out that kind of information and reconstruct potential food webs from the fossil record. But if you look through a coprolite, you can find undigested material. Say, for example, if that animal was a predator, you might be lucky enough to find bits of bone shards or scales or fur. Similarly, if an animal was herbivorous and mostly ate plants, depending on the efficiency of its digestive tract, you might be able to find remnants of whatever it was eating or plant-shaped voids. Coprolites can also contain parasites and their eggs, as well as bacteria and fungal remains, which are things that we don't normally find in the fossil record. By the way, if the idea of studying coprolites is grossing you out, rest assured they don't smell. At this point, they're basically rocks. While I'm no microbiologist, the surface of a coprolite probably has about as much bacteria as your phone does. Getting back on track to discuss the actual science of today's random fossil fact, a team of scientists studying coprolites wanted to see if there was anything interesting inside them and accidentally discovered a new species of extinct beetle from the Triassic. This beetle looked a little worse for wear, but it still had its legs and antennae attached. It was essentially on par with insects preserved in amber, which is absolutely incredible when you consider that this insect went for a roller coaster ride through the guts of another animal and then came out the other end. The paper is entitled Exceptionally Preserved Beetles in a Triassic Coprolite of Putative Dinosauriform Origin, and that was published by Martin Barnstrom and colleagues in 2021 in Current Biology. And that paper is free to access. Just so we're all on the same page, this isn't the first record of an insect in a coprolite, but it is the first insect species named from fossil feces. And of course, this means that there might actually be more species of insects discovered from coprolites in the future. Getting back to the specific details of this study, though, these beetle remains were identified when the fossil was scanned at a synchrotron. It's kind of similar to X-rays in that it shows what's going on the inside of a fossil. More accurately, a synchrotron is like a CT scanner at a hospital, but they're able to detect really subtle differences in density and produce high-res images. And in case you're wondering how a synchrotron works, it scans objects by accelerating particles in a massive loop and focusing a beam of energy at the test subject. I should also add, synchrotrons are massive. The whole building is shaped like a massive donut, and everything else is built onto it. At least that's what the synchrotron in Melbourne is like. There are other facilities like this around the world, and synchrotrons can be used to help study all kinds of fossils, everything from specimens in limestone to amber, and in this case, fossil poop. You're probably wondering at this point, if these paleontologists discovered an almost complete beetle, how big can this turd be? Well, it's actually not that big. The coprolite at the center of this study was actually a partial poop, about 2 centimeters in diameter, which is little over 3/4 of an inch, and just 1.5 centimeters long, so just over 1/2 inch in length. But you know what they say, good things come in small packages. Inside that one fragment of fossil feces, they found tons of beetle fragments and relatively complete individuals too. Most of those fragments were elytra, which are the tough, shield-like coverings that protect the flight wings in most beetles, as well as other bits and pieces. And if you're struggling to picture what elytra are, think of a ladybug with their spotty wings. Those are the elytra, and they cover and protect a second pair of wings which pop out and they use to fly around. So in this coprolite, there were 9 good specimens, and out of those, 2 were almost complete beetles with their antennae still attached. These beetles were just 1 millimeter long, so they're absolutely tiny. The team of researchers named this beetle Triomyxa coprolithica. The species name, coprolithica, obviously is a nod to the discovery of this insect inside fossil poo, and Triomyxa is a portmanteau. So it's a combination of the words Triassic, which is the time period this little bug came from, and Myxophaga, which is the suborder this insect belongs to. Modern day members of the Myxophaga are also incredibly small and aquatic to semi-aquatic, and they mostly feed on algae. It's nothing short of a miracle that the near complete beetle specimen survived the trip through the digestive tract of another animal, but those fragments I mentioned before, they came in clutch and helped Martin Fakacek, a co-author on this paper and expert in modern beetles, determine that this was a new species of fossil beetle and the taxonomic family it belonged to. Beetles, like other insects and arthropods, have an exoskeleton. Essentially, they walk around wearing a suit of armor. The bits that make up a beetle's exoskeleton are called sclerites. They're kind of like the plates that make up a suit of armor. As it turns out, beetle experts define different species based on the sclerites. And since the coprolite had a ton of different examples of these sclerites, this really helped Martin Fakacek piece everything together. Plus, he was then able to then compare these against the almost complete beetle specimens. Now, for the skeptics out there who might be wondering, well, could this beetle be behaving like modern day dung beetles? You got a good point there. And this is actually something that was raised during the peer review process. Peer review, by the way, is when you get other scientists to check your paper for scientific accuracy. Every scientific paper goes through this process, and it happens way before the research is posted online and is announced to the press. Stuff like that.
Pals and Paleo will be right back. This episode is brought to you by Dinosaur Trips. Dinosaur trips are exactly what they sound like. Each itinerary gets you up close and personal with experts and gives you backstage access into the world of paleontology, visiting museums from across the world, and even getting you onto real life dinosaur digs. There's a bunch of trips running in 2024. Alberta Badlands and Beyond is back, and so's Badlands Family Adventure. Personally, I'm eyeing off the trip to Arizona and California because I'm dying to see the La Brea tar pits, but then again, I'm also tempted to travel to Patagonia. To learn more about the 2024 trips, you can check out their website, dinosaurtrips.com, and sign up to their newsletter to be the first to find out about the new trips. And you can email Zach on zach@dinosaurtrips.com, and Zach is spelled Z-A-C-H. It's been 66 million years. Why wait any longer? Join Dinosaur Trips on the adventure of a lifetime.
So So what makes this team of researchers confident that the beetle inside this coprolite was in fact digested and not a dung beetle? Well, it's because there's at least 50 fragments of the same species, and most of these are pretty badly broken up, which is what we'd expect to see for stuff that's been eaten by another animal. On the flip side, if these beetles had crawled into that poop after it came out the other end, we'd expect to see more whole specimens and potentially fewer individuals. The coprolite is from the late Triassic, about 230 million years ago, from southern Poland. So at this time, there are dinosaurs, but they haven't diversified and really taken off yet. And if we zoom in at this particular locality, there aren't many dinosaurs, but it's believed that Psilosaurus probably made the coprolite in question. Psilosaurus, by the way, is a bit of a contentious character. Depending on who you ask, it's either a dinosauriform, so not actually a dinosaur, but very close to that lineage, or a very early basal dinosaur. According to lead author Martin Varnstrom, Psilosaurus was probably omnivorous and would have eaten other things aside from beetles. If you're keen to learn more about this research, you can check out episodes 127 and 128 of Paleocast, which features interviews with two of the paleontologists on that paper, Dr. Martin Varnstrom and Dr. Martin Fakacek. Paleocast is another great paleontology podcast that has experts on to talk about their research. And if you want to hear more from me, there's a Paleocast episode that I did with them on Ferrodraco. If, however, you've been waiting patiently to hear me talk about Dunkleosteus, don't go anywhere because I'm about to give you facts on the form, function, and family groupings of this fantastic fossil fish. So if this is your first time listening to Pals and Paleo, we talk about fossils through the lens of form, function, and family groupings. And at the end of each episode, I tend to sneak in some extra little goodies about pop culture references and stuff like that. Before we get into all that, let's talk about some basic info first, set the scene a little bit before I then introduce you to Dunkleosteus. This is normally the part of the show where I would mention how old Dunkleosteus is in years, but since there's 10 species within this genus, the waters are a little murky. But we're sort of hanging out in the geologic time period spanning 382 to 358 million years ago. Like I said before, we're hanging out in the Devonian, which is also called the Age of Fishes, and that's not to say there weren't other cool things alive during this time period, but the oceans were absolutely popping off during this time, and the diversity of fossil fish is at an all-time high. The Devonian is the period in Earth history that gave us ammonites, which persisted for millions of years, and I'll undoubtedly cover ammonites in future episodes. But during the Devonian, the continents looked completely different compared to what they look like today, and life on the land was starting to heat up. We see vascular plants, plants out of water and on the land forming the first forest during the Devonian. They're soon followed by arthropods, which explode in numbers and species diversity, and it wasn't long before those arthropods were then terrorized by amphibians who also came onto the scene. So there's lots of cool stuff going on at this point in Earth history, but on this episode, we're going to get the facts on fish. As far as prehistoric fish go, Dunkleosteus is kind of a big deal. It's a type of placoderm, but I'll talk about what that is later when we discuss family grouping. But for now, all you need to know is that there are 10 species in this genus. The most famous species belonging to the genus Dunkleosteus is Dunkleosteus terrellae. There's a lot of buzz surrounding this species in particular because it's absolutely massive, not just for the genus, but compared to fish in general, including modern day sharks. Dunkleosteus terrellae is also the state fossil for Ohio in the US and has been since March 2021. So again, it's another fossil emblem birthed from the absolute mess that was the COVID-19 pandemic. The name Dunkleosteus literally means Dunkle's bone. Osteus means bone, which you might recognize from the word osteoderm, which means bony skin. And Dunkle, as you might have guessed, is actually someone's name. Dunkleosteus was in fact named in honor of David Dunkle, a former curator of vertebrate paleontology at the Cleveland Museum of Natural History in Ohio. So even though there are 10 species within this one genus, for the rest of the episode, just assume that I'm talking about Dunkelosteus terrellae to keep things simple, but also there's some cool research I want to discuss a little bit later. You won't just be hearing from me on this episode. There are also two guest experts who are going to jump in and out. Both are from the Cleveland Museum of Natural History in Ohio, and they are Amanda McGee, the Collections Manager in Vertebrate Paleontology, as well as the Assistant Curator of Vertebrate Paleontology, Dr. Caitlin Kaleri. Again, the Cleveland Museum of Natural History is the museum that David Dunkel himself worked at, so I'm so stoked to have both Amanda and Caitlin on to help me talk about this incredible fossil. Plus, they have a bunch of fossils of Dunkelosteus on display and in their collections, and some new displays planned for the future, but more on that later. For now, let's focus on the form of this fossil fish and discuss the shape of its body and size as well, because I did tease at the start of the episode, this is basically one of the biggest things in the oceans during the late Devonian. Like modern fish today and a bunch of other marine creatures, Dunkelosteus has a torpedo or a cigar-shaped body. This is a case of convergent evolution, when things that are unrelated evolve similar adaptations. So from the outside, things can look really similar, but when you look under the hood, or at their skeletons as it were, they actually look really different. I'll also talk about this later in family grouping, but Dunkelosteus isn't related to modern fish, like at all. It actually belongs to a group that is now completely extinct with no modern day descendants. Like almost every other fish you can think of, Dunkelosteus would have had fins, including a dorsal fin on its back, a caudal or a tail fin, probably used for propulsion, pectoral fins, which are kind of what we think of as the arms of the fish, and they possibly had even more fins than this, but long story short, we don't actually know. You might also be wondering, okay, well, if it's got a tail, like, what's the shape of the tail? Is it kind of asymmetrical, like in a shark, or is it crescent moon-shaped, like in tuna and swordfish? Again, we just don't know. That's because Dunkelosteus fossils are often just the head and shoulders, and the rest doesn't preserve. I wanted to make sure I didn't have it twisted, though, so let's bring in the experts.
I am Dr. Caitlin Kaleri. I am the Associate Curator of Vertebrate Paleontology at the Cleveland Museum of Natural History. And I didn't know who Dunkelosteus was until I started working here, but I have very quickly become obsessed by looking at all of the fossils that we have here in the collection and going out and looking for more.
One of the many things I asked Dr. Caitlin Kaleri about was her thoughts on the size and what the rest of the body of Dunkelosteus looked like, but as she points out, without any direct evidence, it's a mystery just waiting to be solved.
We don't really know. I think the short answer is we don't really know exactly what the rest of Dunkelosteus looked like. We only find their heads preserved, which were bony plates, so they preserved really well. The rest of their body was cartilaginous. Estimates of the length of Dunkelosteus range from 4 to 10 meters, so it's an absolutely huge range, and it's because we just haven't found their bodies preserved, and this group of fish is extinct, and we really don't know exactly what they looked like. So there have been some ideas about how big it was or what the rest of its body looked like, but until we actually find its body preserved, we really can't say for sure.
So in terms of the maximum size of Dunkelosteus, there's still a bit of mystery surrounding the size of this colossal fish. Just this year, though, there's been at least 2 papers published trying to grapple with this research question. Just how big was this fish? One of those was published by Russell Engelman in PeerJ, which is an open access paper. We love to see it. And they wanted to see whether sharks were something that could be used to accurately determine the size of the ancient armored fish, the bigger group that Dunkelosteus belongs to. So in the past, the jaws of Dunkelosteus were found, and then they estimated the length of the body as if it were a shark. But since sharks aren't modern day descendants of this lineage, it might not be the best idea. Anyway, to work out whether it gave accurate results or not, Engelman applied this method to arthrodires that are complete. And basically, this study wanted to verify whether this actually worked. And as it turns out, it's not a great idea. The article was titled, Giant swimming mouths, oral dimensions of extent, sharks do not accurately predict body size in Dunkleosteus terrellae, and then in brackets, placodermi, colon, arthrodia, and brackets. But if that's too much to remember, just check out the show notes because I'll have a link to that paper. And yeah, they found that arthrodias, these ancient armored fish, they have proportionally larger mouths than, say, sharks. So in this regard, they're actually kind of more similar to catfish. Russell Engelman also published another paper that came out this year. And yes, I realize that this now sounds like a Russell Engelman episode rather than one on Dunkleosteus. But they then came up with a solution to this problem of, well, how do we accurately estimate the size of Dunkleosteus now? So they came up with a mathematical equation to estimate size, and they put this together using multiple different species of arthrodia as well as some modern fish. And in total, they made 3,169 observations and included 972 species in their study. Basically, what they worked out is that if you can pinpoint the position of where the eye was in the skull, which is called the orbit, and then measure the distance between the orbit to where the gills were, you can work out body length. And then they use some math to back up this equation by working out the statistical significance and quantify using numbers that, yes, this is pretty reliable. And if you want to check out that paper, it was called A Devonian Fishtail, colon, A New Method of Body Length Estimation Suggests Much Smaller Sizes for Dunkleosteus terrellae, brackets, placodermi, colon, arthrodia, and brackets. And yeah, I realize I sound like a total wiener saying all this stuff, but that's what I'm here for. I do all the hard yards for you, and you don't have to read the papers if you don't want to. So you're welcome. That paper, by the way, was published in the Multidisciplinary Digital Publishing Institute, which is abbreviated to MDPI. So based on that second paper, Dunkleosteus terrellae, which again is like the biggest species in this genus, adults would have been about 3.4 meters, which is equal to 11 feet and a little bit. So overall, suggesting a somewhat chunkier body for this Devonian-aged fish. So less of a cigar shape and more like a nugget with fins. Okay, maybe not that extreme, but anyway, the whole situation is kind of like, we don't know a lot about fossil sharks because we only find teeth. Sharks are mostly made up of cartilage, but their teeth, they're made of harder stuff, which is dentine, and they can fossilize a lot easier. Same with Dunkleosteus. The skull is made of bone and there's other bony plates around near their shoulders, but beyond that, the rest of the body was made up of cartilage. If you're not familiar with cartilage, by the way, just touch the tip of your nose. That is made up of cartilage. So it still holds its shape, but it's not as hard as bone. Like, you can smush it a decent bit, but it'll just bounce back. So yeah, scientists actually have no idea what the body length is for sure, but also the shape of the fins on Dunkleosteus. There's been a bit of guesswork, and as it turns out, most of the paleo art depicting Dunkleosteus is based on one of its close cousins called Cacosteus. We know a lot more about Cacosteus purely because complete fossils of that species of fish have been found, as Amanda McGee from the Cleveland Museum of Natural History explains.
I am Amanda McGee. I am the collections manager of vertebrate paleontology. So most of the reconstructions that you see in Dunkleosteus are based off of another placoderm that is preserved called Cacosteus. So a lot of the reconstructions on the tail shape and the fin shape are based on these other placoderms.
This happens a lot in paleontology, by the way. Since the fossil record is often incomplete, you need to connect the dots, as it were, and fill in gaps to estimate what the rest of the animal looked like based on other organisms that belong to that same group, which is fine 99% of the time, but every now and then you get a weirdo that just defies all logic and reason. Even though we don't know for certain how long or how big Dunkleosteus was, we can learn a lot about how it lived based on the fossils we do have. What puts Dunkleosteus head and shoulders above all other fish species is the bony armor that makes up its skull and shoulders. This isn't unique to Dunkleosteus, but it's a pretty good feature to have, as it doesn't just protect Dunkleosteus from predation, but its jaws are highly modified to the point where the lower jaw is basically a DIY knife. What I mean by that is placoderms lacked teeth but possessed dermal bones associated with the jaw known as nathal bones. There's a silent G at the start of nathal. And these differ from the teeth that you and I have because our teeth are in sockets, which are also known as alveoli, whereas these nathal bones are more like bones pretending to be teeth, if that makes sense. It's all connected together. It's bones doing their best impersonation of teeth. And by the way, these fake teeth aren't something unique either. Off the top of my head, it's evolved independently. There's Pelagornis, which is an extinct pseudo-toothed bird, which had a beak with these spikes arranged almost like teeth, which it probably used to help catch fish. So rather than having a series of spikes though, Dunkleosteus kind of had these fangs instead, which were obviously still super effective and got the job done.
I always like to say that they basically made their own teeth because they didn't have teeth. We think about teeth, they sharpened their jaw bones, which is just a wild thing for an animal to do. And they also had an incredibly hard bite and a very fast bite. So it was definitely not a fish that you wanted to run into in the ocean.
Yeah, not gonna lie, it kind of looks like a fish dressing up as Dracula for Halloween. Like, those fangs aren't massive, but they're still giving vampire energy, in my opinion. And the final point I want to touch on, since we're talking about the form of Dunkleosteus, is that it probably had something called claspers, which I'll get to in a minute. We don't have direct evidence for claspers in the genus Dunkleosteus, but this was something other fish in this group had, so it's pretty accepted that the same's true for Dunkleosteus. I feel like I've spent ages talking about the form, trying to paint you a word picture so you get an idea of what this sea beast looked like, but I don't want to bore you, so we're going to pivot now to talk about function. What exactly is it doing with its body, and how does it fit into the bigger picture? What is its role in the ecosystem that it fits into in the Devonian-aged ocean? The million-dollar question right now is, if Dunkleosteus had these incredible jaws made for chomping, how good can it bite? And more importantly, how can you look at the bones of an animal and work out how strong the jaws were, and how do you measure bite force? Good question. So if you've done a little bit of physics, you might remember that force is measured in newtons, which is of course named after Sir Isaac Newton. And if you combine the mass of an object with how fast it's accelerating, the product of that equation is force. So in terms of bite force, a bigger animal has a larger mass, but the secret ingredient to a strong bite is moving quickly. Of course, this would also put you at an advantage since you'd have the element of surprise and potential prey would have less time to get away. But on top of that, you can actually crunch through bone if you're quick enough. And it looks like Dunkleosteus would have been able to bite through things like other armored fish and bite through their bony plates, as well as the shells of things like ammonites and arthropods. They did this with something called a four-bar linkage system, which is a term that pops up in machinery, robotics, and basically you have four bars connected by four links. There's different types that move in different ways. But yeah, as it turns out, you can also study fossils from this same perspective to understand how things move and the physics behind them. Just FYI, I'm not good at biomechanics and studying how fossils move. In fact, physics was my worst subject in year 12. It didn't help that the boys in my year 11 class constantly bullied me because I was the only girl in my class, but yeah, it's not something that I'm naturally good at, so I don't really study fossils from this angle. And it's quite complicated. It's not like you 3D scan the fossil and a computer program does all the work for you. You still need to look at the fossil and work out where the muscles attach onto the bone. But once you map out these landmarks and compare these with modern animals to estimate the thickness of that muscle, then you can work out bite force. So bringing this back to Dunkleosteus, yes, it was probably one of the largest fish during the Devonian, but the fact that it was able to rapidly move its jaws, that was key to the success for this fossil fish. Now, there's a couple different papers that have studied the bite force of Dunkleosteus terrali, but part of the equation is the total length of the body, which, as we've touched on this episode, can vary anywhere between 4 to 10 meters, depending on who you ask. So that would be 13 to just shy of 33 feet long. So the numbers vary a little bit, but it looks like the bite force is the strongest at the back of the mouth or the rear dental plates compared to the tip of the jaw. And I'm just going to read a little bit from one of the scientific papers I looked at. It says, jaw-closing muscles power an extraordinarily strong bite, with an estimated maximal bite force of over 4,400 newtons at the jaw tip and more than 5,300 newtons at the rear dental plates for a large individual, 6 meters in total length. This bite force capability is the greatest of all living or fossil fishes and is among the most powerful bites in animals. Again, like I said though, the bite force gets bigger in larger sized animals. So if Dunkleosteus was bigger than 6 meters, which is equal to 20 feet long, it would have had an even stronger bite. By the way, those numbers were pulled from feeding mechanics and bite force modeling of the skull of Dunkleosteus terrellae, an ancient apex predator. And that was written by Philip Anderson and Mark Westneat and published in Biology Letters in 2007. And that paper's in open access if you want to check it out. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. So Dunkleosteus has a strong bite, and even though the numbers vary a bit, it has a bite more powerful than a hyena's. Since hyenas have a reputation for being able to crunch through bone, just about everything would have been on the menu for Dunkleosteus. So that would mean it's an apex predator. Since nothing is hunting Dunkleosteus and it's in what we would consider to be the best position in the food web. I'm guessing that if Dunkleosteus ate other placoderms, as in other armored fish, there might have also been some cannibalism going on. But Dunkleosteus not only had these funky jaws, they also had armor protecting their heads, which is great because that'll protect the brain as well as their shoulders. But the torso and the tail weren't covered in bony plates. I think this is actually really clever and a good trade-off because it offers protection, but it's not too bulky, so you can still move around with ease and have a bit of speed, especially if the movement of the tail is really important for moving through water. And the final thing I wanted to talk about in terms of function are claspers. I mentioned them before, but I didn't say specifically what they were used for. Now, I have done my best not to swear on this podcast and keep it PG, but I can't talk about Dunkleosteus without talking about sleeping with the fishes. Not how the mafia define it, but the way Troy McClure defines sleeping with the fishes. Things are about to get hot and steamy up in here. So if you don't want to hear how fish get down and dirty, or you don't want to answer uncomfortable questions from your kids, feel free to skip through the next couple minutes because we are going to talk about claspers. You've been warned. So when I was studying second year biology, I was shocked to discover that some fish are viviparous, meaning they give birth to live young, meaning that there's some internal fertilization in some species of fish, which just goes to show how little I knew about fish back then. Now you might be wondering, how do they pull it off when they're in water? Good question. That's where claspers come in. The PG explanation is that, okay, just imagine two ships and they're next to each other. Or maybe submarines is a better analogy. The point is, claspers kind of stabilize the two vessels and allow passengers from one ship to hop on board the other. This is why I shouldn't be a sex educator, because I'm talking about the birds and the bees, but I've complicated things with fish and ships now. This might be the first and last time I talk about reproductive organs on the podcast. And if you are relying on me to accurately explain how reproduction works, don't. Anyway, this is kind of what modern sharks do today, but with similar structures, which have evolved independently in what is known as convergent evolution. Convergent evolution is kind of like when you and someone else come up with the same idea and you both get in trouble with your teacher, even though it was just purely a coincidence. I feel like there's a lot of convergent evolution, especially in the oceans, but normally it affects the overall shape of the body. But there you go, a hyper-specific example that absolutely no one asked for and may even result in some complaints. We'll see how we go. And on that note, let's move on from function and talk taxonomy with family grouping. Dunkleosteus is a type of fish, but it doesn't belong to any of the modern groups. It is in fact a type of placoderm or armored fish. Since this is also our first time on the podcast talking about a fish and we're discussing taxonomy, I am obliged to tell you at this point that there is no such thing as a fish. Even though, yes, you probably know what a fish is, you know where to find them, and if you ask a small child to draw a fish, they'll hopefully draw a blob with at least a tail fin, possibly a dorsal fin, and maybe some gills for good measure. But fish aren't monophyletic, which is something I've mentioned before when we talked about reptiles. If we were to include the descendants of all fish, that would include you and me, dinosaurs, mammals, birds, amphibians, you get the picture. Just about every other vertebrate living on land shares a fish ancestor. No matter how hard I try, though, people don't like it when I call them a fish. So for all intents and purposes, we're going to use fish in a casual sense. But yeah, just keep that in mind going forward. Before we talk about Dunkleosteus specifically, I also just want to quickly run through the types of fish we find today. Broadly speaking, there are two major classes, chondrichthyes and osteichthyes. Chondrichthyans are cartilaginous fishes, so things like sharks, skates, rays, and sawfish. So rather than having a skeleton mostly made of bone, most of the skeleton in these fishes is made up of cartilage, but there is still some bone in the body. And just to clarify, the ancestral condition is a bony skeleton, but sharks and skates and all their relatives have opted to use cartilage instead to build most of their body since it's lightweight but still strong. Generally speaking, these fish have 5 to 7 pairs of gills which are exposed. So if you see one of these in an aquarium, you can easily see their gills from side on. As the old saying goes, though, there are plenty of fish in the sea, and the other type of fish are osteichthyes, which are bony fish. The most obvious difference between the two is that osteichthyes have proper bone throughout their body, so their skeletons are like ours, but they also differ from cartilaginous fishes in that they have something called an operculum. This is a flap that protects their gill slit, which is super important because this is how they breathe and get oxygen out of the water. Getting back to the Devonian, though, there was a huge variety of fish, hence why it's sometimes called the Age of Fishes. The first osteichthyans and chondrichthyans pop off in the Devonian, but there were also jawless fishes, which includes things like hagfish, and armored jawless fishes. The most famous group of fish from the Devonian, though, has got to be the placoderms, which is the class Dunkleosteus belongs to. And then if we zoom in, within placoderms, there's another group called Arthrodira, and that's another group that Dunkleosteus fits within.
And Dunkleosteus was the top predator at that time, and it was wiped out. And because of that, well, sharks survived extinction, and sharks were able to go on and diversify. And that never would have happened unless that extinction had happened.
Now, I realize I've been a bit slack with your subliminal Latin lessons, but in case you were wondering what placoderm means, derm means skin, or it means in, and plaque or plax means flat. So together, the word placoderm actually means flat plates. The earliest placoderms are from the early Silurian, and there are currently over 200 species of placoderm identified from the fossil record, but this group went extinct at the end of the Devonian, roughly 358.9 million years ago. I just want to highlight something here. There was more than one extinction event in the late Devonian, but the one that wiped out the placoderms and was the last straw, got rid of them forever, was the Hagenberg event, also referred to as the Hagenberg crisis. Placoderms actually survived an earlier extinction event in the late Devonian called the Kelvasser event. Guessing it's German? Looks German, so I'm pronouncing the W as a V. Hope that's correct. Then another 13 million years later, the oceans were depleted in oxygen, and honestly, that's how a lot of marine species get wiped out during extinction events, because like us, they need to breathe oxygen. It's just that they get their oxygen from water and we get ours from air. The poor placoderms had to deal with low oxygen levels in the oceans, as I mentioned before, but on top of that, they also had to deal with global cooling and glaciation, which extended down to the South Pole. So for species that were adapted to living in warmer waters, there was no escape. Within the placoderms, Dunkleosteus belongs to the order Arthrodira, which is why I've been slipping in the term Arthrodias a little bit throughout this episode. They were originally thought to be bottom dwellers living life in the slow lane, but Arthrodirans have torpedo-shaped bodies that are built for speed. And you might be thinking that they were all sort of predatory, but as it turns out, there were actually a bunch of different ecological niches that these fish filled during the Devonian. Here's Dr. Caitlin Kaliri to tell us a little bit more about some of the other fish in the sea.
There were a lot of other fish related to Dunkleosteus that were around at the time. And I think that Dunkleosteus gets a lot of the limelight, and the other Arzrodires are sort of in the background a little bit. But there were other weird bony armored fish back then too, living with Dunkleosteus. And they were in every niche. Some of them were slower moving shell eating creatures. There was a big filter feeding fish called Titanichthys that was like Dunkleosteus sized, but was more similar in personality to like a whale shark. So it was just a filter feeder just hanging out. So Dunkleosteus was a super cool fish, but it was also part of an ecosystem. And there were a lot of other cool fish at that time too.
If we zoom in, Dunkleosteus belongs to Pachystiomorphae, which are interpreted as ocean fish and long-distance swimmers, which ties in with the extensive geologic record for this genus. I mentioned at the beginning of the show that fossils of Dunkleosteus are known from parts of North America, Morocco, and parts of Europe, so their active lifestyle helped them disperse to new areas and be successful across different parts of the world. Now, we've known about Dunkleosteus for 250 years, so unsurprisingly, the family and superfamily are both named for this fish. So Dunkleosteus belongs to the superfamily Dunkleosteoidea and the family Dunkleosteidae. If this podcast thing doesn't work, maybe I'll start a YouTube channel where I pronounce scientific names and then give that up. Speaking of YouTube, let's wrap things up and talk about where else you can learn about Dunkleosteus and how this fossil fish has influenced pop culture. To round out the show, I've searched high and low across the internet for video games, TV shows, and other media featuring our fishy friend Dunkleosteus. I guess if we were to stay on the theme with the whole form, function, and family, this is the fandom section? Am I using that word right? I don't know, sometimes. As I get older, my understanding of how to use words like that just gets worse and worse. Anyway, don't mind me. First things first, I am a mad Animal Crossing fan, have been since it came out on the GameCube, and since the very beginning, you can dig up fossils in that game. There's also always been a museum in your town where you can donate fossils to, which again, is pretty cool, especially when you start to have a decent fossil display. There is a Dunkleosteus in the latest incarnation of the game, Animal Crossing New Horizons, which you can play on the Nintendo Switch. I mentioned at the start of the episode that Dunkleosteus is the state fossil for Ohio and that there's 10 species within this genus. But I reckon the Dunkleosteus fossil, as it appears in New Horizons, is based on Dunkleosteus charolii, which is the main one we've been talking about on today's episode. But the reason why I say that is it's a dead ringer for specimen CMNH5768 from the Cleveland Museum of Natural History. Chances are, if you've seen a replica of the dunk at any museum, it's based off this one fossil. Getting back to the game though, in New Horizons, some fossils are made up of multiple pieces, as in there's a T-Rex head, torso, and tail. But there's just the one Dunkleosteus fossil, so once you find it, you can hear a bunch of facts about it from Blathers, the curator of the museum in the game, who is a great horned owl. Speaking of Blathers, if you want to hear what Blathers has to say about Dunkleosteus, I highly recommend you check out the podcast Beyond Blathers, hosted by Olivia DeBercier and Sophia Osborne. They've done an episode on this armored fish, and on other episodes, they cover the fish, insects, and fossils that appear in New Horizons. So if you love that game and want to learn about science, check it out. It's literally a match made in heaven. By the way, having been on Beyond Blathers a couple times now, I can tell you hand on heart, Olivia and Sophia are some of the sweetest science communicators you'll ever meet. When we recorded our episode, it literally just felt like hanging out with friends and talking about science. It was so much fun. And if you want to check out our episodes, the first one was on Amber. So just search for Beyond Blathers, Amber, Adele Pentland, and that will pop up. And the more recent one was on the pterosaur Pteranodon. That'll be up in the show notes along with the other podcasts I've mentioned on today's episode. In terms of other video game references, there is a Dunkleosteus Pokemon, but wait, there's more. So in the 8th generation of Pokemon, Sword and Shield, which is loosely based on the UK, there are fossil Pokemon. This is something Pokemon's explored since first gen. I mentioned it in our episode on Anomalocaris, but in case you missed it, you can find fossils as items and then later revive them and have fossil Pokemon join your team. Cool concept, right? Very, very 90s, because at that point there was this zeitgeist surrounding fossils and extracting DNA from fossils, spurred on by the success of Jurassic Park. In Pokemon Sword and Shield, they played around with this concept, so instead of finding one complete fossil, you were then set with the task of combining two halves and bringing them together. Which again, is fine, that's how paleontology is a lot of the time, but what makes me salty though, is that there are no right answers and you end up with these dumb garbage Pokedex entries trying to explain why these creatures went extinct. The closest you can get to a Dunkleosteus is Dracovish, which is a reverse mermaid made with a fish head but then a dragon body, or Arctovish, which is all fish but still messed up because the head is upside down and then facing the wrong way. I'm gonna be really real here. I hate this concept so much. I was geared up to buy Pokemon Sword and Shield, found out about the mechanics of fossil Pokemon in this game, and went, yeah, nah, not for me. I don't play a ton of video games anymore. I used to when I was younger, but between, you know, running the farm and doing my PhD, a full-on RPG is a big-time commitment, so I'm super picky about what games I get into these days. And if I'm gonna invest in a game, I want to enjoy every second of it. You know, I'm trying to chill and relax. I don't want fossils to become the butt of some sick joke. Like, this is gonna sound super cheesy, but paleontology is one of the things I love most in the world. I can't even describe how grateful I am that I get to study ancient life and uncover their secrets. Especially because after I finished my honors degree, I thought I would never get to do a PhD because some stuff happened. But that's a story for another time. Getting back to Pokemon though, they could have made it so that if you pieced together the fossil incorrectly, the revival process didn't work. I could get behind that, but the fact that you have these straight up dumb Pokedex entries trying to explain why this thing went extinct, it literally hurts my head. It makes me so mad. Listen to this one for Dracovish. Its mighty legs are capable of running at speeds exceeding 40 miles per hour, but this Pokemon can't breathe unless it's underwater. What a mess. And the one for Arctovish isn't much better. In Pokemon Sword, the Pokedex entry reads, though it's capable to capture its prey by freezing its surroundings, it has trouble eating the prey afterwards because its mouth is on top of its head. And in the Shield version, it reads, the skin on its face is impervious to attack, but breathing difficulties made this Pokemon go extinct anyway. I think, I have a lot of thoughts, but I think the most upsetting part is that because of this mechanic, they effectively ruined a whole generation of fossil Pokemon. Like, fossil Pokemon are some of my favorite, but speaking as a paleontologist, they're absolutely terrible, which is so unfortunate because Dunkleosteus is so cool. They could have done something really amazing with the design, but instead they did Dunkleosteus dirty. I get it. I sound like such a curmudgeon complaining that the new Pokemon suck and the first Pokemon was the best when out of the first 150, two were literally piles of sentient goo. But this, they went too far. Like, I've loved Pokemon ever since I was a little kid. Just ask my brother about it. But yeah, as it turns out, I'm now a bigger paleontology stan, and if I had to pick between them, I'd choose bones and rocks every time. Anyway, thanks for listening to me rant for what feels like 5 minutes, but I actually feel a little bit better now that I got that off my chest. I'm keen to hear whether anyone else agrees with me, or if you like these Dunkleosteus-inspired Pokemon. If you don't know what they look like, by the way, I'm gonna make a meme with the Dunkleosteus Pokemon you deserve, in a side-by-side comparison with Dracovish and Arctovish. If you want to find it, I'm going to start the hashtag Justice for Dunkleosteus. It's not as catchy as Justice for Barb, but actually, you know what? Justice for Dunk has a really nice ring to it. Hashtag Justice for Dunk, it'll be on the Pals and Paleo Instagram. Considering Dunkleosteus is hyped up as the apex predator of the Devonian, it's popped up in a couple documentaries, but honestly, I thought there'd be more entries listed on IMDb. I guess it's kind of overshadowed by Megalodon in that regard. If you're interested though, Dunkleosteus makes an appearance in Sea Monsters, A Walking with Dinosaurs trilogy, which came out in 2003, but just bear in mind that in the 20 years since that came out, we've learned a lot more about this fascinating and fierce fish. In terms of physical objects, I feel like there's a lot of museums these days that sell models of Dunkel Osteus. In fact, I have one at home, and I got it last year when I went to Lightning Ridge on my birthday and visited the Australian Opal Centre. Pretty sure I also saw the exact same one in the gift shop at the Melbourne Museum, and I think Darren Naish has posted a photo of the 3 or 4 Dunkel Osteus models he owns. So yeah, there's a good chance that you can get your own Dunkel Osteus at your local museum. It'll just be, I don't know, in amongst the dinosaur and other prehistoric animal toys. Of course, it would also be remiss of me to not mention where you can see Dunkel Osteus in person, and obviously the Cleveland Museum of Natural History is one of the best places you can see fossils of Dunkel Osteus, and they actually have some really exciting developments in the works. And who better to tell us than Dr. Caitlin Kaliri, and she also wanted to let us know when you can expect to see those new exhibits open to the public.
I'm very excited about all of the new exhibits that we are currently developing around Dunkel Osteus. We are featuring Dunkel Osteus multiple times in the new galleries that we are working on right now. And it's going to be really exciting to show Dunkel Osteus as well as all the other fish from the late Devonian period that are represented here in northeastern Ohio in a bunch of really exciting and interactive ways. So I'm excited for that to all be a real thing in the end of 2024, early 2025. We're also working on some really exciting digital content surrounding Dunkel Osteus, including an animated short.
Unfortunately, Caitlin didn't tease any titles, but for the moment in my head, I'm just calling it Finding Dunk. That would also be excellent. Last pop culture reference to round out the show before thank yous, Dunkel Osteus makes an appearance in the second Dinotopia book, which is called The World Beneath. By the way, in case you've never heard of it, Dinotopia is a work of fiction and focuses on humans interacting with prehistoric animals. I personally haven't seen any of the movies or read the books, but in my husband's childhood bedroom, there's a framed Dinotopia jigsaw puzzle that's kind of like depicting a medieval fair, but folks are riding dinosaurs. But yeah, there's some submarine sea exploration going on in the second installment of Dinotopia, with Dunkel Osteus making an appearance and at least one other marine creature. I know it's been ages, but I'm not going to give anything else away because spoilers. Started out with the fish. How did it end up like this? I've been waiting the whole episode to do that. Anyway, I feel like I say this every episode, but I had so much fun putting this together for you, and I hope you enjoyed listening to all the random things I had to say about this super rad fossil fish. Thank you so much to Francie for editing the show, and he's just one of the best people to have on board, and obviously brought the theme song to life, literally. He sings it as well. He's the lead singer of Hello Kelly. And if you enjoyed listening to the theme song, you think it's a bop, check out their latest album, Sweet Nostalgia, which is available on Apple Music, Spotify, Bandcamp. Basically, if you're listening to the show, you should be able to find some of Hello Kelly's music. And I also just wanted to give a shout out to Caesar. He's my soundboard for the podcast. And yeah, his knowledge of The Simpsons has come in clutch a couple times with the early episodes. And if you hate my weird Simpsons quotes each episode, they're almost always my idea, but not gonna lie, Caesar also encourages this behavior. So if you could aim your flaming torches and pitchforks at him, that would be great. The Pals and Paleo podcast cover art is by Jenny Zhao, who you can find on Instagram at JennyZDesign, and we connected through Crumpet Clubhouse, which is a collective of freelance creatives in my hometown of Melbourne. Thanks, Jenny, and thank you, Crumpet Clubhouse. Last thing, thank you for hanging out with me today. I hope you enjoyed hearing about this fishy friend. By the way, we are just over the halfway mark for season one, so if you love the show, let us know, rate and review the podcast, share it on social media, and tag us so we can see it. Or if you know someone who's into dinosaurs and fossils, tag them in our posts. Pals and Paleo will be back soon with another episode, but until then, just keep digging and just keep swimming.